It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Harold Altenbrahm, who astoundingly has agreed to be here just minutes before.
I'm not exactly sure I am.
Harold runs the National Book Foundation, responsible for the National Book Awards, and many of you know this coming week is the week. So he's got quite a lot on his plate, so we're really happy to have him here. In addition to being executive director of the National Book Foundation, Harold has translated books, has edited a number of anthologies. I'm not going to rattle off the names. You have the bio in your program, but we're very, very happy to have him here. And delighted to have him interviewing Tiffany Anik, who's quite a remarkable writer. Her first book, a collection of short stories, Escape from a Leper Colony, is out from Grey Wolf Press. And I have to say, it's an astounding, beautiful book. It's just one of those books you pick up and you read. We were talking about first lines. I don't know if Tiffany read the opening, but you read the first few lines of this book and you know right away it's a great book. There's no question. Anyway, without further ado, Harold and Tiffany.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and welcome to everybody. I think this is our third or fourth year of the conference, and I think I've been doing these lunches. This is my third or fourth as well, and they get better and better, and actually the person I interviewed gets more and more pregnant as time goes on. The first year I did this, it was Jessica Hagedorn, and she wasn't pregnant at all. Last year, Marie Mockett, who was 6.5 months pregnant, and this year you are about 8 months pregnant, is that correct? So we have agreed between the two of us that I won't ask anything mean, and so she doesn't go into labor. If she does, I think they actually closed the hospital down the street, didn't they? So
that's right.
You will have to help me
deliver her.
You will be a witness at the first literary birth at the Literary Writers Conference. So, but it's a pleasure to be here to interview you. As I'm sure Jeffrey mentioned, Tiffany is one of the 5 young writers with 1 book out who, or actually in this case this year, 2 of them have not published their first book yet, who were chosen by former National Book Award finalists and winners as 5 under 35, and they're writers, fiction writers, whom former finalists and winners of the National Book Award believe have great promise as fiction writers and a great career in front of them, and we've done it. This is our 5th year. And this year, Tiffany was chosen by, I don't remember who you
were. Jane Ann Phillips.
By Jane Ann Phillips, that wonderful writer who was a finalist last year for Lark and Termite and is a terrific novelist and short story writer in her own right. So it's sort of a passing of the torch in many ways. Or I guess you could call it an anointing, and which might actually be a little bit more appropriate with considering your short stories. There's a sort of an anointing from these older, more established writers to younger writers. So let me ask you, right from the very beginning, the way we're going to do it is Tiffany's going to read for a few minutes, and then we'll talk a little bit about her budding career, and then a little bit about her book, and then she'll read again. So let me ask you if you'll start off by reading a little bit for us.
Sure, thank you. Thank you guys for coming. Thank you for being here. I'm going to start by reading, not the first story, since Jeffrey has already made the first story sound marvelous. I will start by reading something totally different. I'm going to read from Street Man, which is a story in the collection, close to the front, but one that's really strange and different than other stories in the collection. And it's told from the voice of a guy who is a street man. He's a drug dealer, actually. So you want to pretend like you don't have pregnant me in front of you, and instead you have this Caribbean drug dealer in front of you. Street Man. Let me tell you how I meet this sweet thing. It's Christmas time, so the place fill up with people from the ships and the resorts. She walk into the sun shack like she one of them tourists. She even talk all Yankee. I don't really bother with she because I don't want to be all Stella get her groove back. I let the white lady help she. But Yolanda walk over to me on her own, and then her voice change up, and she sound like any island girl all of a sudden. She want to know about the Maui Jim sunglasses behind of me, so I take them off and tell her that they look good when they're on her face. She don't buy a piece of shades, but she leave me her number and I don't even self-pretend to not watch her ass as she leave. For 2 weeks, we spend some big amount of time together, every day, Sometimes I just drive my 4Runner to her house on my lunch break and park in the middle of the street. I tell her jokes about the red-faced tourists who come into the shop, how the woman does tell me that my accent don't even sound like English, but some exotic native language, how the man then does lean in quiet, and ask where they could score some weed. Yolanda does laugh so hard that she had to sit on the pavement and lift her legs scissor-like into the air. She tell me that in college, they ask her where she buy her sneakers because they didn't think Nikes could sell anywhere but the States. But when she says stuff like that, it's not funny anymore. It gets all serious. And I think that's a real good thing that she have a sense of humor and some seriousness and maturity to boot. When we talk serious, it does make her want to kiss right there on the sidewalk. And I let she all the time, in the beach, in the water, on the couch, in my living room. I never let a girl do me like that before. One night, we sitting in my car parked in the middle of her street. Since the last hurricane, St. Croix don't have no street lights in the neighborhoods. If you get too close to either side of the road, the house lights shining directly into the car. So we was parked in the middle where it's dark. We ain't have sex yet, but since I a lot older than her, 10 years older actually, I cool that she keeping cautious. I ain't no young boy, I just coolin'. Yolanda's on my lap snaking away, getting her nut, I kissing on her neck and thinking how this young girl have me acting like a schoolboy. She wearing tight white pants and because it's so dark, that's all I could see clearly, and her teeth when she laugh and a white in her eyes. At this point, we've been seeing each other for those 2 weeks, and I already know that she like to laugh and kiss and even do both when we fooling around. I like foreplay. I'm good at it, you know? I mean, I like the whole shebang, but an older guy know that foreplay is sweet, and just doing it is for dogs, and I too old for that. Now a car is coming on the street, and I have to drive around the block with Yolanda in my lap, and me having to look up under her arm to make the corners. Man, she loved that stupid stuff. Laugh so loud, I have to give her a hard stare. Hush no, girl, your laugh will wake the dead. When we reach back in front of her house, she go to me, I have to tell you something. I know what she gonna say just by how her item all small and her mouth all slack, and I don't want to hear it yet. So I say, get off my lap. When she's sitting there in the passenger seat, I try to relax my heart and my dick because the blood in both is slamming away. Don't tell me, I say. It's too soon for that. But we've been dancing all night, and now she's been on my lap for almost a half hour. I have to say it because it's true. So I let her. I love you, Slick. Damn. Leave it to a young girl, a college girl, to fall in love and have to tell you the minute it friggin' happened. I pissed, but I don't have no choice to admit it back. Okay, Yolanda, I love you too, but now I gotta say something. And I tell her about what I do on the side, how I deal sometimes, how I have a gun under my seat. I take it out and I show her. She get all quiet like she gonna cry. And right then, I don't know if I want to hold her and tell her that I gonna be done with that shit if she would be my shorty for truth. And I'll move with her to Tallahassee where she in college. But I just want to kick her out of the car for being such a damn softy. Tell her I need a ride or die chick and not some goody-goody college girl that don't know nothing but the street. See me? I ain't gonna change for no man, woman, or child. But she don't cry. She just rests her head on my shoulder. Shit, Slick, is what she say. And her voice is so sweet and she seems so for real. I decided on wait this girl out because she could be the mother of my youths. And so I tell her, if you're gonna be my woman, you can't be calling me Slick. It's Anton, but don't be screaming it in the street.
Thanks. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about your career, the beginning of your career. I know it's an interesting part when you're talking about having one book and your one book just coming out that you have a career. But obviously you had a career before the book came out. And let's talk a little bit about about the business of becoming a writer and sending out your stuff and getting acceptances and rejections. Any great acceptances and any great rejections that you want to share with everybody?
A lot of this stuff happened really early, probably too early for me.
What does too early mean?
I was in high school when I started beginning to think, oh, maybe I'm a writer. I had really great teachers who said, yeah, there's such a thing as writers and you could be one. I've been writing my whole life. I don't even know myself not writing, but I didn't have a conception of a writer who could make a career out of this. I thought that, you know, writers just kind of staple the books together and then like send them to bookstores, which I guess still does happen sometimes. But I had no concept of like sending stuff out. And so early on, I was told by one of my teachers, who was well-intentioned, to send my poems to one of those like best who's who kind of things that maybe some of you fell victim to when you were in high school or something. And you basically pay the Library of Congress, or maybe not Library of Congress.
It's the National Poetry Library.
Somebody to like publish your poem, which is kind of crazy. And you think that's how it works. And then it comes back and there are like another million poems in this book. And yours is like in teeny little print. And so I didn't know if I should be proud of that or not. I was actually pretty proud of it for a little while until I knew better. And now I'm kind of ashamed of it. And the lesson there, I guess, is to wait until you know a little more about publishing to start publishing, or at least until you know the places that you would like to be published. So it wasn't until grad school that I started actually reading literary journals and figuring out which ones that I really loved and which ones were my favorite and which ones that I would subscribe to or buy in the bookstore when I found them. And that's when I realized, oh, this is where I want to be published. So that was my bad experience. But I also, in high school, had a really good experience early on. Another teacher, well-intentioned, I had great teachers, nominated me for this prize on island. I'm from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. And we had just had a huge hurricane, Hurricane Marilyn, which did similar damage to us that the hurricane did to Haiti, actually. And we were just decimated. We didn't have electricity for 3 months. You know, you drew your water out of a well, and it was pretty intense. And towards our recovery, this big arts organization decided that they would bring these artists to the island to like enliven in us and make us excited about life again. So they brought like Ishtek Perlman and all these huge people, and they also brought Maya Angelou. And the prize that I had been nominated for was connected to Maya Angelou's visit, and I won the prize.
This is for poetry, or
it was for any kind of creative writing. And you could submit anything, and I submitted a story and a poem. And I won the prize, and I remember I was sitting up on the balcony, and I don't know if you guys have ever seen Maya Angelou perform, but she's like so flamboyant and amazing. And she came on the stage, and instead of doing her, you know, kind of one act show that she normally does, she started off by reading my poem. And I thought, fuck. I almost flew like out of the balcony. My grandmother was like holding my hair. So that was, I had those two dual things of like, oh, I'm publishing this book with a million other 16-year-olds, and then this other thing that was like, oh, but wait, there's something possible. So.
Do you still write poetry?
I do, secretly.
Secretly, what? I mean, do you switch to short stories?
Well, I think a lot of writers, if they've been writing their whole lives, probably have written in all the genres and didn't think, oh, I have to choose one. The world kind of tells you that you have to choose one, but kids don't even think there's a need. So I started off writing everything. I had a journal, so I did some memoir stuff. I wrote poems, and I wrote what I thought were novels in like first grade, but were thankfully lost somewhere.
But what about novels now? I mean, when you sort of, you've had success with the short stories, and because you've won prizes for your short stories, and I mean, are you working on a novel?
I am working on a novel. In fact, I was working on a novel when I wrote the stories. I mean, as far as business is concerned, I'm still working on that novel, and the stories were a kind of breath as I worked on this, what is a very lush, big, family epic-y kind of novel. And I realized that there were things I didn't know about craft. I was in grad school, and I decided I would teach myself these things by doing it in small form first.
When you said it's things you didn't know about craft, what didn't you know about craft that you know now?
Well, you know, you think you know how to write in first person, and then you do it, and you're like, this rocks, and then a week later you're like, this sucks. So I had to figure out how to do that, because I wanted to use different first-person narratives in my novel, and I decided that I would do that in my story. So a lot of the stories have like 3 and 4 first-person narratives inside a short story, and I had to practice that, and the stories were a great way to practice it and learn how to become somewhat masterful at some of that stuff.
Now, when you're changing voices, are you also changing consciousnesses?
Absolutely. I really believe in the validity of the first-person voice. I mean, there are a lot of third-person stories in here, too, and omniscient also. But I think if you're going to do first-person, you have to really rock it out. Otherwise, it's a failure. I think you have to, it can't just be my voice. Then what's that? I really want to honor the character. So each first-person is a different diction that I'm going to use, a different tonality that I'm going to use. They're going to have different word choices, different sentence structures. I'm really careful about making sure that their dialect, if they do speak in dialect, is specific not only to their culture, but to their person. I'm really careful about all those different levels of first person.
Mm-hmm. And in the novel that you're working on, you gotta, because in your book, in this book, you actually separate them out, and it can actually seem like you are trying to figure out, okay, now I'm switching to this one, now I'm switching to that one. Are you going to do the same thing as time goes on, or are you going to begin to say, okay, we're not going to be as divided as that?
We'll see. I mean, it's still in progress. Right now, it's pretty separated. And I would like the reader to really feel that the character has been announced by the new voice, so that the separation to me is has a lot of validity. So we'll see how it ends up, but right now they are very unique spaces, structurally in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the title of the book and the title story. I mean, in putting this book together, how you work with I'm assuming that you worked with an editor, Gray Wolf, You know, you had this group of short stories that you had written. You had gotten several prizes for several of them, and you decided to put this together. What did you leave out?
That's a great question. I did leave out one story that I think will become a pivotal part of the novel that I'm working on, that just had a different energy and voice and movement than the other stories, mostly because I had written it much more recently. And everything else was written in the same 3 years of my life, and I was going through something very similar for those 3 years. I was in grad school. I was raising my little brother. I was missing home desperately. And so a lot of that stuff is in these stories that story didn't have. That story was called Rooted, and maybe I'll publish it someday as a standalone. But right now it's being integrated into the novel.
Mm-hmm. And you were in grad school where?
The University of Houston. It was in Texas.
Which is where one of the stories is set, right?
Yeah, there is a story set in Houston, which is actually a later story. I needed to live in Houston for a while to get a sense of what was magical about Houston to me. Poor Houston.
Who did you work with her?
I worked with Chitra the Vaccaroni, who was really an amazing teacher and has been an amazing mentor. I worked with Antonia Nelson, who was also wonderful. I work with Claudia Rankin, who's a poet, and she's been very wonderful to me as a poet mentor, but also as a fiction mentor, just as a writer mentor. She's very generous and super, super smart. I don't know if you guys know her work, but you should find her work if you don't have it already in your shelf.
Mm-hmm. So. Thinking a little bit through the process of, I'm assuming you have an agent?
I do.
And your agent submitted the book to the agent, and how many agents rejected it before your agent took it?
You know, I was lucky because I had started winning prizes, and in fact, I won a big prize for the title story, How to Escape from a Leper Colony. I won the Boston Review Prize, and then an agent started contacting me, so I was able to kind of like pick and choose which ones I wanted. But that was a really hard process, actually, because you don't know, do I want some big, famous, powerhouse agent? Do I want somebody small who's going to love me and love the book and think of it as her baby? Like, what do I want? And I ended up going with someone who it was kind of in the middle. She's an excellent agent, but she's in a larger agency. But she was also one of my teacher's agents. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a secret. Sandra Dykstra is my lead agent of the agency, mm-hmm. and my personal agent is Elise Capron,
mm-hmm.
Who's wonderful. And is also Chitra de Vaccaroni's agent.
Based in San Diego.
Which
is odd for an agent.
Very odd. Yeah. I was like, what are you doing? You need a New York agent. And I was like, but I like them. So, whatever. And I feel like maybe it's not such a bad thing. Because when they come to New York, people are like, oh, we never see you. What do you have for us this time around? Versus like, oh, we always see this agent. 24 hours a day we see this agent. So, I think it's a little special to have my agent out in San Diego. But they've been very kind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So tell me, the next step after you get the agent, Sandy, or at least submits it to different presses, and where do they submit it, and where do you...
I'm not as on top of the business stuff as I probably, well, maybe I shouldn't be, who knows, it's kind of up to you and your personality. Like, I don't follow my Amazon rating or any of that kind of stuff. That freaks me out.
You don't follow your Amazon rating?
I know.
There's this thing called Title Z where it follows it for you.
Oh, shit, no, please. I don't want to even know about that. Because that will freak me out. I will just get obsessive, I think, if I follow that kind of stuff.
Well, you know the old story about when Truman Capote was on... was on tour, and everywhere he'd go, he was in a limousine, and he'd ask the driver to stop at the local public library, and he'd look in the car catalog to see if his books were there, and then he'd look to see how many of Norman Mailer's books were there.
And then he'd never wrote again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't want to be that. But I will say that weird things happened that were emotional weird things, so I remember them, when my book was being sent out. So, first of all, people don't really want a short story collection. So most people were like, sorry, lady.
And when you say people don't want them, are you talking about the large mainstream presses in New York, or are you talking about the very high quality literary presses outside of New York, or also inside New York, but the high quality literary presses that are not part of the big six, let's say?
Well, definitely the big houses are really hesitant to take short story collections. But even the smaller presses are hesitant, because they still need to make their profit. And Grey Wolf is a non-profit literary press, very, very high literary, but even they publish very low, they don't publish many short story collections. So the novel is queen, okay. And I knew that the story collection was gonna have a hard time finding a home. And so I think we did what many people do, which is kind of try and shock the collection while saying, and there's a novel coming. Which is what often agents will do for any of you who are fiction writers and have a collection. They'll be this like, and someday she will write a novel, don't worry, and it will be yours. So people are really buying the novel, and they're just like kind of like, okay, we'll take this collection kind of thing. But that's not what happened with me. I didn't really have the novel coming at that point. So, but what I did have was really strange responses from presses I can't remember now, but probably for the best, where they said things like, we already have our black writer, so we can't take another one. We're so sorry.
That does happen. I mean, if you talk to Asian Americans, they also say exactly the same thing. We have our Asian American writer. And I think with Latinos, and particularly with Latinas, they're always looking for the next Latina star, the new Terry McMillan of the Latino world. But yeah, you do find that, and it's really odd this day in Asia that's what they do.
Yeah, it was awful. It was disheartening because people would say things like, "Oh, your work is amazing. This is so great. I wish I'd seen it before I saw so and so's, because I would have maybe bought yours instead of so and so's." But we can only have one of you.
Publications.
Publishers. And I also had. Well, we already have our Caribbean writer. Not for the year, but we have one Caribbean writer on our house, period. And
couldn't you find some other category that you fit into?
It was pretty crazy. So even if the one black writer a year, the one Caribbean writer for the whole house, I was having a hard time. And they would say wonderful things about the work and then say, but we can't market you against so-and-so. And I was pissed off at them, but then I also realized that they were also trying to make their bottom line. And as much as publishers should have a mission and maybe be thinking about overcoming racism in readership, it's also about readers. That readers aren't necessarily buying tons of black literature or literature written by black writers or tons of literature written by Caribbean writers. So they were responding to the market. When you went to Barnes & Noble's, you just want a book, but if you want... my book might not be in the regular book section. It might be in the back, in the black book section. And most of you are not going to go to the back just to find a good short story collection. So the whole thing is messed up.
Mm-hmm. Did you go through? And this is a bit of a sideline. Have you gone through the idea of when you go into the bookstore where you take the book and you turn it face out?
I've done that. Hell yeah! Yeah. I've actually gone into the Barnes and Nobles and been like, I want it on this shelf. Front of the bookstore. But I feel like, But the next day, it's back where it was originally. So there's somebody, a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to go into Barnes and Nobles too much, so it doesn't happen. But yeah, that's somebody's job, right? Then to go around and make sure that all the crazy writers in the neighborhood haven't turned their book out or moved it.
So let's talk about how you decided to make the title story the title story.
That was hard. Originally, I had thought I might name the whole collection Kill the Rabbits, which is the last story in the collection, and a really meaningful story to me. But I started telling people, like, maybe I'll name my collection Kill the Rabbits, and they were like, oh, the animal lovers are going to hate you. I was like, no, it's a metaphor for something else. And they were like, no, what are you doing? So then I had to kind of rethink, well, what would be a good title? And I didn't think about the language, which I should have, of the title. I think it worked out, though. But I was thinking about what this story represented for the whole collection and which story, if people read that story first, which often you do, even if it's not the first story, which it happens to be in my collection, often people will read the title story first. I thought, well, how will that open up the collection for people? And I realized that the whole collection has this one thing in common, and maybe this one thing alone, because the collection is really diverse in its craft and in its topic, was that everyone was kind of searching for love or place, all the characters, and that the stories are really about this like hunger for love and place, and that How to Escape from a Leper Colony, that story did that in the most concrete way, both those things. Because the characters are actually on a leper colony, and there's a 14-year-old girl who's fallen in love with a 16-year-old guy who's been in a leper colony his whole life. And so there's this longing for place. They want to leave the leper colony, but they also want to kind of find each other in a deeper, meaningful way.
And in a way, she actually, I mean, the idea of searching for place and setting down roots, she actually leaves a piece of herself in the leper colony, even as people are escaping. I mean, they cut off a piece of her and they leave it there, and then it's sort of like almost buried there as sort of a talisman of what goes on. There's also an interesting thing that I think that runs through a lot of this, and it's sort of your own idea of what religion, superstition, magic, all that stuff. In virtually every story, there's something about that. And was that something conscious, or was that something that just simply came out of your trying to reflect the culture?
I think initially it wasn't conscious, not in the writing stage, but it's something I'm conscious of in my own personality, in my own persona. So, you know, whoever you are, that's what comes out in your writing. And I am really fascinated by religion and myth and truth and how all those two things kind of create the world that we actually walk around and live in. I grew up Catholic, and sometimes I'm still Catholic.
But there's not a lot of purity in all of this religion. I mean,
that's
no one is really, even the
Catholics
nuns.
Pure? What?
But even the nuns in the opening story are really, I mean, there's a sort of a fallen aspect to all of this.
Well, I'm not only interested in Catholicism. I growing up in the Caribbean, every member of my mother's generation is a different religion. My uncle is Rastafari, one of my aunts is Muslim, my mother is Pentecostal, my grandmother is very, very Catholic, and she raised me, so I grew up Catholic. I mean, people are all over the place. And that was normal, to come home and you have Thanksgiving prayer, and people are like, Allah, Jesus, you know, Muhammad, whatever, like, Selassie. So there was all this stuff, and that seemed very normal to me. And so it was part of who I was, but it was also something that I thought I should put this into the writing because it seems truthful to the Caribbean experience and to my experience. But initially it just came out in a very organic way.
So there's nothing, I mean, there are certain things that you talked about before that were schematic, for example, in setting out the type of consciousnesses that you're trying to establish. So that part of the thematic is not schematic in any way.
Right, yeah, it's not.
It's just organic and intuitive that that's what, sort of what was going on. Because I think, you know, at the beginning, one of the things that draws people into the collection is that idea when the two young kids are in that, you know, I guess, the hut, when they create this...
The goddess.
You know, you begin to see that there is a sort of fall and corruption, that nothing in the rest of the book is going to be this sort of pure, you know, because it's in within a Catholic environment, but it's a fallen Catholic environment of lepers and you know, a mother abandoning her child, all these things that sort of undercut the idea of, you know, whether it's Christian love or maternal love or Afro-Caribbean religion, all that, that there is going to be a fall and a fire and things are going to get burned up. And then the nuns are going to be swimming off the island in their habits. And it sort of does set the tone for the rest of the book, I think. So.
That was the point, yeah. And that was conscious. But, you know, everything happens, the good stuff often happens in revision. So once I realize, wow, I'm doing a lot of religious stuff and a lot of spiritual stuff here, then I could use it more effectively. But initially, it was definitely...
Did you tone it down? When you're saying revisions, when you revised, how did it change?
Well, I didn't tone down. I always believe in ratcheting up for the most part. I mean, I cut a lot. I kill off all my babies, my darlings, all the time. But I don't think that there's a need to tone down lushness or things that might scare other people. And oh, I shouldn't have too much prayer or whatever. I'm like, whatever. I can pray and like curse people out in the same sentence. So I feel like I wanted to keep all that stuff in there. But I also, in knowing that I was doing this religious stuff, I wanted to do it in a much more thoughtful and careful way, maybe than I had just sort of gutly been doing it. So in the first story, for example, it's Catholicism, there's Hinduism, and then there's the Orisha faith from Nigeria that has made its way to the Caribbean, sometimes in the form of voodoo, and sometimes in the form of Santeria, and all these things are on the island. And once I realized that I was doing this, then I had to go do research, because I don't know anyone who actually practices Santeria or Orisha. So that's where the revision came in, so that I could actually do that as honestly and truthfully as possible.
The other part about that is there seem to be talismans that are sort of, well, they're not quite symbols, but they're sort of touchstones, thematic touchstones throughout the book, like the goddess and all that. Were those things that, again, are they organic, or are they things that you sort of put in there and said, aha, these characters need this talisman to sort of bring out their approaches to the world?
Well, a lot of that is organic, but I wouldn't say, often when we think, this writer is doing this thing unconsciously. We think it's like the writer is doing it stupidly or something. Like, I'm just a writer and I'm not smart, I'm just an artist. So it wasn't like that. I mean, it's something that I recognize that to build character, you have to build like all parts of them. So you have to know what kind of underwear they have on and like what they eat for breakfast and what's the thing that they would carry around with them or what's the worst thing that happened to them? How are they gonna die? You have to know everything about them. What do they love, and what's the world around them? So in doing that, things like talismans become really organic to the characters and really organic to my process of creating character.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think I've found interesting about it is that the traditional short story in the United States has always been a short story of the significant moment, mm-hmm. where you actually get to a point, and it's sort of like the Henry James short story, which is sort of like held up as the pinnacle of those short stories. And there don't seem to be these significant moments in your story where it's sort of leading to that, and then suddenly after that, things just sort of tied up. And are you conscious of that when you're writing, that there's not a significant moment, a gunshot, a this or that?
Well, I love stories like what you're calling the traditional American short story narrative, which at least in grad school, people thought, we could trace all that back to Chekhov or something. But I'm also interested in another trajectory of the short story, which comes from other parts outside of Europe, whether it's the African story where people gather around and people tell you the story of what happened to wolf and rabbit or whatever, or how I grew up. My grandmother was a librarian and she told stories to the kids in the library. In fact, they're naming the children's library after her, the children's library on Island. Which is, they're big, sweeping, almost novelesque kind of short stories where there may be many, many characters, where you're as much talking about a culture or a world or an entire like state of being as much as you are about an individual character's epiphanic moment. So I'm really interested in these big, lush short stories. Like, what can the short story do? And I think we think often it can do this thing, this like small thing, but I want to push it. Like, what all can it possibly do? And so I really wanted to do that in the stories. I was conscious of wanting to push that, but I also made sure that the readers that I was reading a lot of were doing that. So a lot of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, his short stories, we often read his novels, but he's an amazing short story writer. And Jamaica Kincaid's short stories, which are these big, kind of weird, lushy stories, even if they're only 10 pages.
Do you start when you're writing these things? I mean, I think that there's a very interesting idea of what is a past that's not really explicitly talked about, which is an African past, I think, and a Caribbean past that I think was acknowledged as most of it's gone because it was decimated, and then an African American present that you touch on, especially the story set in Houston, but also the fact that there are people going back and forth, going to Barnard or not getting rejected from Barnard, or you know, going to different colleges in the United States and being visited by both blacks and whites from the United States. And there's sort of an interesting idea of what a diaspora means in when it comes, you know, is this the African diaspora? Is it a Caribbean diaspora? Is it, what is it? And where do those characters sort of fit in with that as African-American, Afro-Caribbean, African? Look at the story set in Ghana, all those things. And there seems to be not a continuum, but there is a spectrum of characters from the entire, let's call it African diaspora, that's changing now. I mean, when you're writing those things, when you put the collection together in particular, are you aware that you are filling a lot of those, putting in a lot of those pieces, not filling them, but putting in a lot of those pieces?
That is something I was aware of, and I was conscious of wanting to put in the story of the character who goes back to Africa and ends up living there, because I wanted that to be part of all this connection. So that was very conscious, but the fact that characters are often traveling is part of what links the collection together. The opening epigraph of the collection, which when I found it I was so excited because it really does pull everything together, is, "Lead us towards those we are waiting for, those who are waiting for us." And that's from the prayer to Saint Raphael, and he's the patron saint of lovers and travelers. And so the idea that a lot of these characters are moving constantly seem to be summed up in this idea of them searching for something, you know. And I like the way you explain, like, Africa as past, kind of the Caribbean as maybe more recent past, and African American as a kind of present. But for these characters, all those things that might feel as if they're happening at different times, they're happening at the same time. There's all this flexibility for them that they can go back and forth. And then there's this also this weird thing where characters who are not explicitly of African descent, so white characters, Asian characters, are also participating in the African diaspora.
Well, the Kill the Rabbits, I think, is a prime example of that. It's really with masks as well. And all over the place, they're taking on different roles that they may not be accustomed to or naturally part of.
Right, exactly.
So.
Yeah, and I think, you know, right now, all of us in this room on some level are participating in a European diaspora, right? I mean, the fact that we're speaking English, that's a kind of participation, but we often don't think of it happening in other ways, that white people sometimes participate in African diaspora. When you go to a hip-hop concert, or, you know, I don't know, whatever. Like, and in the Caribbean, the Asian presence is very heavy, which a lot of people don't know, I mean, unless you're from the Caribbean, that South Asia is a huge presence in the Caribbean, and that Caribbean people are participating in an Indian diaspora as much as people of Indian descent are participating in an African diaspora because of the presence, both of them, in the Caribbean. So it's that, to me, it's fascinating. It's where I'm from, but it's something that I'm still exploring.
Now that you have the collection out, I guess a couple of these are partly two or three part question. One is, what did you expect the reaction to be? What did you expect people to take from the book when they read it, or hope that they would take from the book when you read it? The second thing is, what have the reactions been so far from a variety of different sources?
It was really complicated for me. I mean, I wrote the book not wanting to think too much about potential audience, because that would scare me away from doing things that I might not otherwise do. It would make me say not curse, because my grandmother would be like, "I can't believe you put a cuss word, oh my God." Which she still says, "I don't like that story, too many curse words in that." Or, you know, or thinking, "Oh, Street Man is a little bit like my ex-boyfriend in college, and what if he reads it and really hate my guts?" So I had to just kind of pretend like nobody was ever gonna read it, so that I could write it bravely. But what I really hoped, kind of beyond hope, was that people in the Virgin Islands would be really interested in it and embrace it. And this is a strange book, because there is a very vibrant literary community in the Virgin Islands. It's very small, but very dedicated. But most of the literature that's been published about the Virgin Islands has been published by what we might call colonizers, Americans, because we are a colony of America. And so Herman Wolf wrote this book Don't Stop the Carnival, and that's the book you go into the bookstores in St. Thomas, and you say, oh, I want a book about St. Thomas, and you get this book by Carmen Wook, who, like, lived on St. Thomas for 4 months or something, maybe a year or something, I don't know. But it's not from the Virgin Islands, right? And there's a lot of poetry that comes out of the Virgin Islands, and there's a lot of fiction, but most of it is self-published. And so this book, in many ways, is the first book of fiction to be coming out of the Virgin Islands and being published by a press outside of the Virgin Islands and not self-published. So knowing that, I was hoping that this is maybe the beginning of something that we, you know, as once, say in India, in the post-colonial experience, Kipling wrote about India, and that's what we thought India was like, right? And nobody was reading Indian authors, and all of a sudden, people started reading Indian authors, and Indian authors started writing these amazing books, and I think this might be the beginning of something, our kind of post-colonial moment in the Virgin Islands. So I really wanted that to happen, and I went back home, kind of scared about the ex-boyfriend, reading those stories, and the high school students were reading it in high school, which was amazing, and the college professor at the University of the Virgin Islands, who teaches literature, was teaching in his class, so it was doing a lot of like what I really wanted it to do, which was just great. But I was really nervous about the stories that end not well, or that are tragic, and what will the Virgin Islands think about that? Will they think that I'm writing, like I'm airing the dirty laundry? You know, which often, if you're coming from a particular community and then you write about the people of that community in a way that's not, oh, they're all perfect and beautiful, you sometimes get a backlash, like, well, you look, you make us look, you're totally screwing us over. So I was really afraid of that. But so far, it hasn't been that way. It's been very, very welcoming, and people at home are like, well, this is truth, and we're glad somebody is, you know, putting us out there. Because before that, we didn't exist on the literary realm. So it's kind of like if you're from like Minot, North Dakota, nobody's heard of Minot. And all of a sudden, are you from Minot?
No, but I know it was a famous pilot there.
But all of a sudden, there's a movie about Minot. Like, people in Minot are like, oh, yay, we exist. And in a way, for some people, the book was like, oh, wow, look, we exist. So that was really gratifying.
Well, what you need to do is you really need to write the Portnoy's Complaint of the Caribbean now.
And then I really see what the hell
is up. And see what people really think of the way you describe the culture.
Right.
I think we're going to open it up to questions from at the moment, and then Tiffany will read other questions about Tiffany's experience and her work. You know, it's fairly new, so...
Tiffany, well, first of all, congratulations. That's terrific.
Thank you.
Did you ever get to meet Maya Angelou in person?
Well, I did backstage. Uh-huh. I mean, she just shook my hand. I was like, you're the poet. And I was like, no, you're the poet.
did you have her write a blurb in your new book?
No, I didn't even think about that.
You
know, I should.
You should have. You should have her endorse that. I mean, what a perfect opportunity.
Next time. Yeah. You think she would do
that? You can hire me as your publicist.
She'll be like, I don't know who you are.
Oh,
you remember
and she's
15
Oprah's
years
best
ago?
Friend.
Right, there you go. Big time, right, exactly. You should send her a copy.
You guys are all my agent now, all of a sudden.
You know, if Jonathan Franzen can get his get back in Oprah's good graces, I mean, just send her your book with a note saying, you know, I'm a friend of Jonathan Franzen who told me to send this book to you. And you know,
I'm a friend of Maya Angelou.
I was wondering if you could tell us which writers do you regard as your influences, and also if you've read Wide Sargasso Sea, what do you think of it?
Did everybody hear that question? What writers are Tiffany's influences, and if she has read Wide Sargasso Sea?
Well, it's funny because one of the blurbs on the back of the book is from Robert Anthony, who I didn't know at all before he blurbed the book, so it was very kind of him, where he mentions Jean Rhys and says something to the effect that it's as if Jean Rhys had written it today, the collection, which I thought was like amazing because I don't dig a lot of her stories that are set in England, but Wide Sargasso Sea I think is a piece of genius. I think it's amazing. And it was a very, very important book to me when I discovered it, which was late in my life. I mean, late for someone who was thinking of herself as a writer. I didn't discover why I took Grazia until probably my senior year of college. But I had already read Jane Eyre, which, for those of you who don't know, why I took Grazia is kind of Caribbean, like right back to Jane Eyre, where Jean Weiss takes back the woman in the attic, Bertha Mason, and tells her story. And I thought that that was amazing conceptually, but also that she was doing this very political thing by doing that, but also doing it in a really artful, masterful way. So I love that book, actually. Although I think she's a complicated person in our literary history. So I would actually count her as definitely one of the important influences on me. So it's funny that you mention her. And I would also count Jamaica Kincaid and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who I mentioned earlier, not only for their stories, but also for their novels and their nonfiction, and just also kind of what they mean in literature and what they meant to their, in Kincaid's perspective, what she meant to Antigua, and in for Gabriel Garcia Marquez, what he meant not only to Latin America, because now he means something to all of us. He's this, you know, major international writer, but to the Caribbean part of Colombia, which is what he writes about. And he really brought that to life, that there's an African part of Colombia that is a very Caribbean part. So I value what he stands for also.
Go ahead.
How many? First of all, how many short stories do you have in here total?
I should know. There's 20. No, eight. Wait, did I count that wrong? Eight. Yes.
And they're roughly around how many pages each story?
They're really different because I don't have a sense of like, oh, a story should be 15 pages. Okay. Whatever the story calls for is what I'm going to do with it. So there are some stories that are 10 pages and some stories that are almost 30 pages.
Reason,
or more. There's a story that's 45 pages.
The reason why I'm very interested is, so I was laughing about Texas because I worked in Houston, you know, for a number of years. And I've put together a collection of short, very, very funny stories of my experiences, you know, as an emergency room physician working in these areas.
Well,
and everyone is, you can buy it, it's night shift, you know. But everyone had the same reaction. It's like, oh, you can't sell a collection of stories. You can't say a collection of stories. You have to do it some differently. And I thought, but they are all individual stories. But and that's why I was so fascinated by how, you know, you got this all together and got that promoted, because it is hard now. A lot of these, you know,
it is. And I think, you know, what you were talking about before, it does help if you have been published individually elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
and they've sort of gotten some recognition because it's third party endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somebody says, oh, these editors have already seen this, and, you know, this one has won a prize or has been included in a collection about such and such. And, you know, other people have said, that, you know, people in, supposedly people in the know have actually also said, this is good stuff. So they take a look at it a little differently, I think, when a third party has looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a question about your teaching. You teach now, right?
Yes.
In New Jersey, God's mm-hmm. country.
Mm-hmm.
Where in Jersey?
At Drew University.
Sorry, where?
Drew in Madison, right?
That's right.
You teach writing, one assumes, creative
yep,
writing, one assumes. Does your teaching infuse your writing in any way, affect your writing in any way? Do you learn from your students? And, you know, what do you, you know, when you respond to somebody, does your response come from the way you think of writing? Or do you have a sort of idea of being just responding to what they're showing you?
I teach undergrads, so I think it's my job to be as open as possible and to respond to them where they are. Because they didn't, you know, they don't choose me the way grad students choose the program and choose the professor to be their mentor. Undergrads are like, I want to create a writing class. And so I'll, oh, you, okay. So I feel like I need to honor all the possibilities when they come into the room. I really value teaching, period. And I think of it as a kind of sacred relationship that's like, as important as like with your parents, you know, like that important. Especially because my teachers are so important to why I became a writer in the first place. I think there should be like a ceremony for it. I mean, I know there's graduation, but like just you and the teacher, and there's like candles and something, and you get anointed and like wands. I don't know. There should be something because it's a really vital relationship that can like make or break your soul. And so I really want to make sure that I am building individuals and not like taking them on like, you know, rides just to my fantasies and not to theirs. So for me, they are really instructive. I mean, I learn from them. They're reading stuff that I'm not reading, and then I can tell them what I'm reading, but I also teach stories that I don't necessarily love because I feel like I want to give them a myriad of different kinds of fiction or poetry, depending on what I'm teaching. They can find their own thing that they love and not just love what I love, which I think is harmful to them. I want them to love, like, to figure out what they really find exciting. I often have, I've met students who all had the same teacher in undergrad, and they all love, like, the same writer. They're like, oh, we love Carver. I'm like, that sucks. Like, how? I mean, he's a great writer, but, like, what did they do to you?
Stepford
Kids. But, you know, and then they, everybody writes the same kind of story. And I've been an editor, so then you get these stories that are all the same kind of Carver-esque or whatever story. So I don't want to do that to people. So I meet them where they are. But my students are really inspiring to me, not because they're writing great literature, because they're 18, what the fuck are they doing, right? But because they're, like, so excited about it. So they're like, this is cool, this new writer, look what I can do with this character. Like, you know, I can make them talk and walk, I'm God. And that's wonderful. And so they make me want to go home and be God, too.
Are you God when you get home?
Hell yeah.
You spoke earlier about your stories not having, like, a particular big moment, and that's reflective of your history with your grandmother and other kinds of culture.
And my reading, yeah.
Is there anything more that you could say about that and how you craft your story? Does it come into the realm of the craft or does it just unfold?
Did everybody hear that? We were talking about the significant stories of the significant moment and how they're, that her stories are not like that, and whether it's part of craft or whether it's organic.
It's probably both. But because I'm interested in my characters for their whole lives, even though you might only see them on the page as a reader for 5 days or 2 years or something, I really want to tell a story that is representative of their whole life somehow, even of their death, which may never appear on the page, or even appear as a possibility on the page. So I'm that moment where everything changes is a little less interesting to me as a writer, although I like to read stories like that sometimes, than, like, who are you as a human being over your entire life? That's fascinating to me. The psychology of that is really fascinating. And it might come from having been raised by old people, you know? My grandmother and my grandfather raised me. And so I have this idea of, like, this trajectory, you know, of what's possible. And I don't think, I know that I've been told by teachers, like, oh, there's this one point in everybody's life where everything changes. But I feel like that's not true to life, actually. That there might be one point, and then there's another one, and, like, all these things kind of contribute to who you are by the time you, like, you know, go into the ground.
Are you aware of time changes when you write these short stories? I mean, you know, that you're throwing back in time and forward in time, and even though you're sort of like taking a slice of somebody's life, that in order to give them that depth that you want, that there is a time element that you're putting into it?
Time is one of the last things that I'm crafting into my story, but it's something that I am interested in for the same reason as your question, in telling the story. But it's one of the things that when I'm done with the story, it's usually the thing that's still not right in the story that I need to go back and, like, kind of make sure I've done that in a clear, clean kind of way. Because I am interested in flashback and flash forward, and just because I want to tell the story of this person's life in 10 pages. So all that has to come into it. But craft-wise, and, like, how to do that in a very, for lack of a better word, crafty kind of way, happens often at my last stage in my writing.
Go ahead.
From there, and my whole family is from the Virgin Islands. I'm what's considered, it's very contentious to be native or not native or continental. It's a serious issue in the Virgin Islands now. So, but I'm native by all these people's random definitions. So my family goes back even to the Carib Indians, also to the Africans who came over as slaves and to the white folks who came over as slave owners and to everybody, right? But I think I never doubted that there was something authentic about the St. Thomas or VI voice, because I was raised in it, you know, and I heard it all the time, and I spoke it, and I lived it. So I never doubted that this was something that existed. I didn't have to dig and unravel things to find it. But part of what it means to be a Virgin Islander, which is a Caribbean person, also means being an American person at the same moment, which is very bizarre. Only Puerto Rico has that experience alongside of us, where we are often in our own region, we're the Americans, and in America, we're like these weird Caribbean people, right? Who can't vote for president, for example, right? So there's this, yeah, there's a complication in that we're so different from the rest of the region at this point, and yet that's something that's really interesting about us that people haven't talked about yet. You know, like, we talk about post-colonialism and Jamaica and Trinidad end up in that discussion, but what about America's colonialism? And only Puerto Rico and St. Thomas can talk about that. And I guess in Guam and other U.S. outposts. But in the Caribbean, it's only us and Puerto Rico. And so that particular weirdness of being both Caribbean and American at the same time is what it means to be a Virgin Islander. You know, so that was just the truth of the experience.
There was also some, you know, a couple of, you know, throughout the stories, I think the stories are peppered with some ideas of these Americans who just hop in and out, and they become part of the culture there. And, you know, the street man who sells sunglasses to people off the boats, off the cruise ships, and the house that burned down, and they're when they go to see that, it's Americans who come from Texas, and people who just sort of pop in, and they're affluent people who. And I think that's, again, that's also part of the experience, and that sort of comes out, and it's not, that becomes an authenticity even,
right,
even now, because it's a contemporary authenticity, because that is the experience. And I'm not sure that if you want to get to a native voice, that you wouldn't be inauthentic by getting to a complete native voice of something that happened before all of these things that occurred, because it's part of the history.
Absolutely. And we're American only kind of recently, since the 1930s. I mean, 1917, we officially became American, but we didn't become absorbed really until the 30s. So we were Danish before that. And then we were like French, and we were everything. I mean, even Knights of Malta, they don't even exist anymore, but we were whoever they are, we were underneath them. So, you know, our identity has been shifting for a long time. And because we're located in the Caribbean, and we have a similar historical reality as other Caribbean islands, we are definitely Caribbean. But I often have people tell me, Caribbean people, but you ain't really Caribbean. Who the hell is you, right? because we're American. And there's a weird break, because all of the Caribbean was colonized. But now that we're still a friggin' colony, like we're actually like many, many steps behind of Trinidad or Jamaica or Barbados, right? Which have relationships to Britain. I guess Trinidad is really independent, but are much more independent than we are. And in the region, it's like, well, we are free now, so now we're the real Caribbean. But actually, we're going through what everybody else went through, which is taking a lot longer to get out of it. And maybe we'll never get out of it, because it is nice to have those U.S. dollars, right?
Well, so it is interesting. It comes out, you know, throughout the stories, is that the way you just expressed that in language. And I think in Street Man, you wrote before, using the word, you know, the language changes, using the word she as an object pronoun. And, you know, it adds a great deal to whatever the English language around the world means anymore, but it, you know, changes it and gives it a certain flavor that, you know, BBC English doesn't really have. You know? So let me ask you unless there are any more questions, I'm going to ask Tiffany to read, and we'll finish with the sounds of her language.
I'm going to read a very different story, but I just want to thank Carol for the questions and NBF for allowing you to come over here and spend some time with us this afternoon.
Well, I'm the director. I made the decision.
So you're God over there.
I am God. So I don't think the staff believes
it. You have to, you know, sometimes we don't believe, but
I'll cultivate my Godhead.
There you
I
go.
Go back to the
office. Don't tell them I said that. And also thank Jeffrey and Tillam and Pete for having me. Thank you guys so much. I'm going to read from a very different kind of story. This is called The Saving Work. And it's from the perspective of two different women. One is named Deirdre and one is named Violet, just so you can follow when they arrive on the stage. The story is in chapters, but I'm not going to bother with telling you the chapters. But just so you know, structurally, I'm interested in structure also as a writer. And I often have stories that really look like novels in the fact that they have chapters and conclusions and weird things like that. the saving work. A church is burning down. On a Caribbean island in the countryside, up a road that might lead to a saving beach, but does not, a church is burning down. Everyone who is associated with this church will think, my church has burned down. But for now, there are only two women there to look at the fire and blame each other. They are both American women, white, in the middle of their lives. They and their families are members of this church. They are each married to a local native black man. Both of those men are skinny and frail of body. These women, they want to be the strong ones, and they have always been the strong ones. Deirdre Thompson has brought the garlands for the church stairs. She has brought the pew pins and the flowers for the altar. She was the first to arrive and see the bright flames. She's already dressed in her gold silk suit. She saw the smoke from far away in her car, but she imagined some filthy native was burning garbage in his yard. The smoke seemed to disappear as Deirdre drew near the church. This was an illusion. Her car had lumbered its way along the narrow cut in the land that is the church road. The men of the church had laid the road, and as a result, it dips erratically. The arms of thin trees scraped at the closed windows of Deirdre's car, and she wondered why no one had cut them back, and she thought with some worry about how the limousine would make its way. The road opened into the clearing where the church crackled in the center. Through the windshield, Deirdre saw what she thought was just a smallish fire, more smoke than anything, nothing to alert the people in nearby houses some 200 yards beyond the bushes. But now Deirdre knows what she's seeing. She's seeing the end. Deirdre stands a few safe yards in front of the burning church, watching it creak and break. And then she hears an engine sputter and knows it must be Violet Day Flabert's car groveling up behind of her. Deirdre does not turn to greet Violet. And now that Violet has arrived, Deirdre wonders about her own inaction, wonders about her own ability to simply watch the church crack and crumble into ashes. My father killed himself just like this. Violet says this as though she has only meant to think it. It is not something she has said to anyone, and now as she climbs out of her car, she has said it to the fire and to the figure ahead. She is almost hysterical with tears. There really is a church, her church, burning right in front of her, right here on this island that was supposed to be brown-skinned paradise. The suicide is a secret that Violet has kept from her husband and her daughters. Her parents are dead. Her children are told honorable stories. They do not seem to mind that they don't know their white cousins, and Violet has been grateful for their indifference. And now she sees with disgust that it's Deirdre Thompson there ahead, standing before the church as though just watching is serious work, as though the burning was her own doing. Violet cannot remember ever touching Deirdre, even in the peace doing church services, but now she thinks that she should be goodly and move towards Deirdre, closer to the flames, so they can work this fire out as a team. Violet hugs the ring pillow to her chest protectively, the bands sewn gently on. She gives her voice as an offering. My mother, she died in the fire too, Deirdre, though they never said suicide, but it was. And though she's crying, the words are very clear. But Deirdre doesn't move at all, doesn't even acknowledge Violet's presence. And for a second, Violet thinks that she should step forward and hug this woman. But then it comes to her like a pinch that Deirdre is the arsonist. That self-righteous cow would love to see Violet's daughter sullied. Violet clenches her jaw and takes a breath while Deirdre can burn for all she cares. Instead, she asks, can you at least fucking tell me, Deirdre, if our children are inside? I'll stop there.
thank you very much, Tiffany. And remember, the books are on sale back there, and I advise you to get it signed because it's going to be worth a lot of money someday. Thank you.
Thank you.